and welcome to Historically Speaking. This is a fun show with my friend Susan G. Mathis. She is the Vice President of the Christian Authors Network, and I'm the President of the Christian Authors Network. So this is kind of a fun, unique opportunity for me to interview somebody that I work with, but I admire greatly, on genealogy and why she wrote The Fabric of Hope, An Irish Family Legacy. Susan has other books that you can find at susangmathis.com. And, you know, we may have a little bit of fun with some genealogy tips that come in here because she is very Irish, right even down to the T. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Angie.
You know, I have a little bit of Irish in me, too. I did the Ancestry.com DNA test. Have you done any of the DNA testing?
I didn't, no. But I'm Irish way down to the bones. Yeah.
There's something you can feel that DNA in there.
I grew up in a very Irish home. I went to St. Pat's Church. I went to St. Pat's School. My second cousin was second advisor to the Pope.
Wow.
wrote a book on the Vatican. I grew up very, very Irish. The biggest holiday of the year was St. Patrick's Day.
I remember that you, and I still have it, you sent me a green scarf for St. Patrick's Day.
I did.
I have it. I kept that. I thought that was so delightful and fun.
Yeah.
So, what is it that you think was so very unique and different in your Irish family legacy?
Everything.
Well, you're going to have to expand, my dear.
Exactly. Well, one side of the family was 100% Irish. My mom's family was 100% Irish. They were the Grahams and the O'Neills, and then the Hawkins, which you're the reason that I wrote The Fabric of Hope. You didn't know that till about an hour ago.
I didn't, and I'm just so amazed and blessed.
Yes. For the listeners, Angie had just published her book on the quilt. What was the name of it?
A Healing Heart.
A Healing Heart. Yeah, it was a great story. And we went to see her. My husband and I went to a bookstore to see her. I had been acquaintance with her and listened to her story and stuff. And we left that evening and I said, you know, Dale, I could write that story. And I told him the whole plot of The Fabric of Hope. And just jokingly, and he said, "Well, write it." And I'm like, "Yeah, I don't think so. I will never write fiction." Say never. I had always written nonfiction, and so I proceeded to start writing fiction. I started researching it a little more. My cousin was working on the Graham genealogy that bled into the O'Neill genealogy up through grandma. And so she had all that data. And then on the other side, the mother side, there were the Hawkins, but they didn't know a whole lot about that. So I started researching the Hawkins side. And before that, they had thought that everybody came through Ellis Island. My mother thought that until a few years ago when I started writing this book, but it wasn't
kind of like the go-to place, but exactly. My family didn't come through there either.
Yeah. It's not as simple as that. My family came through the St. Lawrence River and actually settled in Canada, and I would have been Canadian.
That is really interesting because that's another thing we have in common. I have two different lines on both my mother's side and my father's side during the American Revolution that split, and the Spears went to Canada, and on my dad's side, there was one brother of the Bigelows that went to Canada, and there's a homestead up there that still exists, and so, yeah, I could have been Canadian too.
So interesting, yes. So it's just fun to learn about all those things. And so, as I was writing this book, I went over to Ireland and I visited all the places
Oh, I'm so jealous.
where they were, where each branch of the family was, and experienced the culture and the food and the people and the setting. And it really helped me to do such a better job with writing the
What was
book.
it like being there? Did you actually go to any grave sites or homesteads, any houses that you know they lived in?
I didn't. I couldn't find those at that point. And I had done the research, but I got as close as Hilltown, which is one of the settings in the book. But I couldn't find that road where their homestead was. So,
And
I didn't.
that's been hundreds of years, or how long has it been?
It was 1850s. Yes, during the potato famine. All three branches of the families came during the potato famine, good Irish. And that was interesting to research all of that, to read books about it, to watch movies about it, to experience and really immerse myself in what it was like for those poor people to watch, to first of all, to be so segregated as Catholics. I mean, the Caulfield family in our family tree, back in the Hawkins, that was the paternal side of the main character, Margaret Hawkins. Her family owned thousands and thousands of acres. They were a very wealthy family, but
Really?
because they were Catholic, they had all that stripped from them and ended up with nothing.
Did you find that area?
We did. We were all around that area.
Okay, so how did that make you just spiritually, emotionally feel? Did you? I just have this sense of the loss.
Oh yeah, it was terrible, and I had to really pray about that because I was angry that actually happened to my blood family, But on the other hand, it helps me to understand apartheid. My kids live in South Africa, and what they must feel like about the blacks and what they must have felt like about all of that kind of thing. It really gave me some empathy for people who have unfairly had things happen to them.
And then I think about the fact that because we are such a fallen race, human race,
Absolutely.
that this has happened
Over and
over and
over.
over and over. This is the story old as time.
It is. It
It, the sin that is within
is.
humanity that they
What's
would take from another like this.
right. Exactly. So all those different things that I learned while researching for this book, and then the other side of the story is my personal story. The Fabric of Hope is about an 1850s Irish immigrant and a 21st century single mom who are connected by faith, family, and a quilt. Well, true story, my ex actually, when he left, he took my family quilt.
Oh my gosh.
My Irish family quilt that Margaret Hawkins started to sew back in Ireland and brought over on the boat with her. He took that and he pawned it. So it was also writing that story as well, because that was the last piece of Ireland that my family had, and they entrusted it to me. And it was very difficult for me to even tell my mother that it was gone, because it was tucked safely in my hope chest, and I didn't think he ever went in there. So,
Why would he? Why would,
exactly.
I know
So,
someone else who stole quilts and stole things like that too, and to this day, nobody can figure out why.
yeah, right.
Except for that it was intended to cause harm, and there we go, right back to that broken human condition.
Right. Exactly.
So, oh my gosh. So do we give away anything in the story if I ask if you got that quilt back, because my heart is just pitter-patting? No. You know.
Yeah, I can't give it away.
Okay. You're not going to tell us. Okay.
I'm not going to tell you.
So people, we have to read The Fabric of Hope in Irish Family Legacy to find out if this 21st century woman got her piece of heritage back.
Yeah.
And what that means to that family. Oh my goodness. Okay. So keep going. Tell us more about your discoveries in Ireland and about yourself.
Wow. Just being there was incredible. Because I could, when I went back to my manuscript, I had already written the first draft of it, went to Ireland, and toured the whole island. We started in Dublin and we went the whole island, and experienced that culture and the people and the smells and the sights and the hills and the dales and the sheep and all of that. I went back to my manuscript and really enhanced it by experiencing it. And that was so much fun.
I think that's one of the most important things of being able to go and experience our history like that. And it's, I want to go do that with Ireland, but not yet. I'm 12.5% Irish, according to my DNA test. Who knows? And then, but I am over half Scottish.
Yeah.
And so that's my next plan, to do exactly what you did, so I can enhance my stories, enrich my knowledge, feel it. What did you prepare for? How did you prepare to take this trip to Ireland? I think this is a good genealogy tip right here.
Sure. You know, I am ridiculous when I go on trips, because I research, if I go on a cruise, I research, you know, every.
I do that too. Maybe it's the writer in us. I don't know. Or maybe it's the genealogist in us.
My husband just rolls his eyes, you know, because I walk around, you know, like we were in San Juan, Puerto Rico, which I'm so glad we went, because it's such a mess now.
Yeah, but we actually have been there twice and adored San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, I had all the facts and figures, and I just give him a self-guided tour. I could be a tour guide any place I've been, because I just so prepare. So when I went to Ireland, oh my goodness, I read so much. I every place, I researched every stop that we were making, especially where, you know, around Hilltown, where and that was in Northern Ireland, is where they came out of. So they
Hilltown, H-I-L-L.
Yes, and there's nothing there. I mean, it's like there's not even a light there. It's just a little tiny itty-bitty town about an hour north of Dublin.
And is that where the big thousands of acres of land was? Is that area?
A little east, a little west of that.
Was there a castle involved? Every American wants to know.
Yeah, no, there must have been, but I couldn't find that.
I have a friend who they own a really small percentage of a castle.
Cool.
And they've never been there. You know, they own it because of the family inheritance kind of thing.
Yeah.
They don't know what to do with it. They just own it.
Right. Oh boy. Yeah. Well, during that time when the Catholics were really being persecuted by the Protestants, they did burn a lot of the information. They destroyed buildings, they destroyed documents, birth certificates. I mean, that's why it's hard to trace back in the Catholic heritage, a lot of Irish stuff. So
I was talking to, I'm actually hiring a Scottish genealogist.
Wow.
And, because even though I'm studying genealogy, I don't feel like I know enough, and I don't have access to some of these records in time, because I want to go and I'm only going to be there for, you know, a short time.
Right.
And I'm going to spend a lot of time doing research, but I want to know where the homesteads and the farms were and things like this. So here's my genealogy tip that comes out of it. If you are descended from Scottish farmers, you are super, super lucky. Because the Scottish genealogist I'm hiring, her name is Alison, A-L-I-S-O-N, Farrar. And she lives in Ayrshire, which is where I believe my family comes from, at least part of it. And she said that because my family were likely farmers, they would have been farmers for hundreds of years. And in Scotland, those are the records that were not destroyed. And what she meant by that, she explained further, if they owned a farm, if they rented a farm, if they were a hired hand on a farm, there are still a majority of those records still exist going back up to 400 years.
Nice.
And maybe more. And nice. That is a surprising genealogy tip that I did not know. And I'm very grateful to her, you know, for telling me that, because now I feel like maybe I have a chance of standing on the ground where my ancestors stood.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's kind of the reason why I was asking you. But in Ireland, evidently, a lot of that stuff was burned. So it makes it even harder.
Right.
Keep telling us your story.
One of the fun things on the trip was that in Dublin, there's a famine ship that you can go to.
A what?
Or a famine ship.
Famine. Like I'm hungry famine?
Yes. Yes. Similar to what the potato famine Irish when they immigrated to England to sorry start again when they immigrated to the States or to Canada, they would take a ship, and it was generally they called them famine ships because so many people were in the midst of famine at the time. A lot of them died on the ship during the voyage because they were so malnourished.
And
we went on this tour of the famine ship, and it was that really helped me to build my story, the passage and the journey on the famine ship, to be able to see and to experience how small and how congested and how tough it was. So,
is it just in dock, or do they actually take you out into the water on this tour?
Just in dock, yeah.
Kind of like the Queen Mary in, in Long Beach. It's in dock, and they don't go anywhere, but you can go on, you can tour it, you can stay.
Experience it, yeah, sure. So all those kind of things, when you're really learning and thinking through what it was like to get on a ship with nothing, and to spend 4, 5, 6 weeks at sea with people you don't know and people that are dying and people that are dead and storms and what does that look like? And they don't know anything about where they're going. And, gives me the willies.
No kidding. And it's to be stuck in there is like, I had an interview recently with another writer who is in the Captive Brides collection with me. And her story was about a woman who was escaping slavery by being put in a coffin. And it was like, here you are facing your biggest fear that you're going to die in slavery. And yet the possible escape from it is being put in a coffin that mimics that sense of death. And I think being put into I know some of the ships were called, coffin ships too, coming over to America and things like this, because of the amount of death and that were done and that happened. And I know, in Scotland, my family may have come over and become indentured servants, which is why I wrote His Indentured Bride for the Captive Brides collection. And as they came over, I found two men's names, Thomas Nelson Jr. and Thomas Nelson Sr., on the same ship. And I put the book back, not knowing what I had found, thinking I had the wrong people because I thought it might be the wrong year. And then a couple of years later, found out it might have been the right people in the right year. But that library is way over in Pennsylvania. And I'm in Montana. And I can't tell somebody which book it is. I just know where it is. And so now I have to go back to Pennsylvania to pick up that book. But it also showed that those two people may have become indentured servants. And that was where the idea of this story came from, because I thought I was on the wrong track. And it turns out I might have been on the right track. And that they would indenture themselves because they were too poor to come over. And then they would serve as an indentured servant. And at the end, they're supposed to be given some clothing, some food, sometimes as much as a year's worth, including seed, and some land sometimes. It depended on the contract. But in many cases, they were considered lower than slaves.
Slaves, yes.
Mm-hmm. Because slaves could be kept for a lifetime, so you got a lifetime out of work for them. So indentured servants, they were given the dangerous jobs because the slave owner didn't want to lose the lifetime work of a slave.
Right.
And so things like that, studying those things really shocked me and kind of blew my mind, because those are things that are not talked about because they're not quote-unquote politically correct.
Right.
And yet, the truth is, more indentured servants died and were just, you know, not really recorded and not really talked about. And yet the records exist that these things happened. Mm-hmm. And it's forgotten in today's history with the way our political climate has gone.
Right.
And so to me, writing this story, his indentured servant, was a way of not only preserving some of our own U.S. history that's getting lost, but also helping me to explore that idea and that concept and how would that have worked and what would have happened. And oh my goodness, you know, it just got fascinating to me to think about what these people gave up and what they went through to come to America to give us the opportunity to be free.
It really helps us to gain a respect for our ancestors, to understand what the sacrifice they made. It helps us to humble ourselves in the beauty that we live in, you know, the ease we live in. And that's the thing that just kills me about history today, rewriting history and writing it just for the convenience of political correctness. I wrote a feature story for Focus on the Family, I don't know, 15 years ago, about revisionist history and how dangerous that is. And I just see it in today's world, how we're rewriting history all the time. The media is, and popular culture and stuff. And it's dangerous because we'll lose that very thing you're talking about, the heritage that, and the understanding and the all of that makes us who we are. And if we don't use it, we'll lose it. If we don't learn from it, we'll repeat it.
Exactly.
I'm
curious, did any of your, what happened to your real people when they came over to the United States? Were they indentured servants? Did they have real struggles from being super, super poor, dealing with famine, trying to deal with, I know in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, there was a huge outcry against the Irish and against particularly Catholic Irish.
Definitely.
You know, what happened to your family when they got here?
We're very fortunate because the Hawkins side, who the story is about, they had an uncle, his name was John, on Wolf Island, Canada, which was one of the thousand islands that's between Ontario, Canada, and New York. That's where I grew up. I grew up 17 miles from the Canadian border.
Wow.
I grew up right there. The series I'm working on now is called the Thousand Island Summer Series.
Oh, I love that.
And it's kind of a Downton Abbey meets the Thousand Islands, you know? And so I write stories on each island. And so I'm almost done with the first book. Chapter 24. Yay.
I have to tell you, the one I'm working on right now is ironically, the sequel to A Healing Heart.
Oh, that's cool.
I know, and it's going to be in a collection with Robin Lee Hatcher, Vicki McDonough, and Deborah Rainey.
And, nice.
Yeah, and it'll come out in February of 2018. But what was exciting about what you said about A Healing Heart, you know, inspiring you, was you gave me more confidence to tackle the sequel, you know?
Nice. Good.
Because you liked it and it inspired you, and it's like that Sally Fields line, you like me.
Awesome. Well, so, good. I'm glad.
So tell us more about your people in America.
Yeah, so they ended up on Wolf Island, Canada, which is the largest island there. But seriously, 6 to 8 months out of the year, they are stranded on that island because the ice forms over. Some because of the currents in the river, they don't freeze over enough to be able to take transportation back and forth. Wow. So they actually hunker down. So when I was writing this book, I did the research on Wolf Island, and then I went up to see my mom, and she and I went to Wolf Island. And we went, we couldn't find anybody online and stuff that were there, but we went, and I tell the story, it's one of the chapters in the book. Mm-hmm. We go there, there's one general store. There's only 1,200 people that live on the whole island, mm-hmm. even today. So I go to the general store and I said, I'm looking for maybe our ancestors were the Hawks. You know?
So you're like going,
Exactly. So she says, oh, which ones? Mike or Joe or Sam? I don't know. She pulls out this teeny little this little book that wasn't even official of phone numbers. She said, here are the numbers. Give them a call. And so I did. The first two I didn't get. The third one I did. They said, oh, we're here. Come on up. So we went up to Hawkins Hill, which is where they ended up, and talked to big old burly farmer Mike Hawkins. And he said, oh, I don't know much about our ancestry, but Mildred, who is 80 years old, she knows everything about everything. She was born and raised here. So she sent us over to see Mildred, and we went there, and she told us all kinds of stuff. And then she sent us to where the homestead was.
Oh, my goodness.
It was the coolest thing.
Do you have pictures of that?
The homestead had burned down years before. But
did you take pictures of Wolf Island at all?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, we need one good representative one for the show notes.
Sure. So it was just a magical time that Mom and I got to share together. Wow. And so when this summer, when I was having a book signing in Alex Bay, New York, which is right across from Wolf Island, the captain of the ferry actually came, and he loved the book. I had him take one over to Mildred, and we became Facebook friends, and he just says, oh, Mildred was so blessed by that.
Wow.
So we've had lots of fun. And in that process, I met the president of the Thousand Islands Historical Association. Mm-hmm. So she is my historical editor for this next series I'm working on.
So. I am so excited about that. When you have that ready to come out, I would like to have you back on. Be so much fun. Can you tell me where in you were not raised right on Wolf Island. What island of the Thousand Islands were you raised on?
I wasn't on an island. I was on the mainland. I was a mainland girl. I was in Watertown, New York.
You landlubber.
But I always was enamored with the islands. I've stayed on five of the islands and different cottages or hotel. There, it is an incredible place where in 1872, Pullman of Pullman Railroad Car fame, he bought an island, and he was friends with President Grant during in the 1872 reelection campaign.
Really?
And he invited him and General Sheridan and another general to come and stay on the island. And so Pullman, being the entrepreneur he was, he got the 200 editors and journalists, and he together to tout the islands. He made an incredible campaign as far as growing those islands, selling islands to the rich and famous, and it became the Downton Abbeys of 1870s up until the Great Depression. There's castles and huge mansions that that people came up from New York City and Chicago and around and bought up these for summer home, built summer homes.
Wow.
There's a castle there called Bolt Castle that he was one of the hotel owners in New York City, built that for his wife, and his wife died before it was fully built.
Oh my gosh, that would be so heartbreaking.
Yeah, but it's a castle that you can actually get married in, stay at, tour. It's a huge tourist industry there.
Wow.
And see how they lived. It's incredible.
Wouldn't mind sending us a link for that to the show notes too, that'd be really cool.
Yeah.
So much fun.
You know, it's a secret. Everybody should see the Thousand Islands. It's an incredibly beautiful place in the summertime, not the wintertime.
Yeah, I hear you looking out at snow falling here, and I have to go into town this evening, and I'm looking at the snow on the roads going, I haven't put my snow tires on yet.
Oops.
I have a love-hate relationship with snow and ice.
Too. Yes.
I have just been so delighted to have you on today. If you could share anything that you wanted to wrap up your family story and with listeners, what would it be?
Don't discount the history that is in your families, because it's a beautiful thing. And once you dig into it, you really learn a lot about yourself, about how you grew up in ways that you never know. Like you spoke of with your Swedish history. There were so many things as I was researching this that I didn't know was part of the Irish culture, you know, that was just a normal life for us. Meat, potatoes, veggies. Okay, that's Irish, you know. Not everybody eats that way. But, yeah, all kinds of stuff. We always had potatoes with everything, even spaghetti.
Wow. That is very unique.
Yeah. I didn't carry that over in my life.
Smart woman. You are so delightful, though, to have on as an interview, and I really hope that when this next series is ready to come out that you'll let me know so that we can share that, because I think people who have history in the Thousand Islands would love to know more about it. Yeah. And how can people find you online?
On anything Susan G. Mathis. So SusanGMathis.com, Susan G. Mathis on Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest. I have a blog that I feature authors. You're coming on soon. Yeah, that's also on my website, SusanGMathis.com, on Goodreads, Google+, and on our CAN website.
And CAN is the Christian Authors Network, and Susan is the vice president, and I'm the president. And we would be delighted for you to visit the Christian Authors Network to not only find great books by really good authors that are professionals in the industry, they have great stories, but they also have great nonfiction. And they also have the opportunity to speak for you if you need a speaker for any of your events. These people do their research and know their stuff, and it's a really wonderful opportunity to get to know some not only great writers and great speakers, but doggone nice people. So thank you so much, Susan, for being with me today. This is Angela Breidenbach. You've been listening to Historically Speaking, and you can find me online at angelabreidenbach.com or on any social media at Ange Breidenbach. We'll see you next time on Historically Speaking.